So we're going to be looking at part of a big text. We're going to be looking at part of the sixth chapter of the Bodhisattva Bhumi, which is part of the Yogacara Bhumi Shastra, by the great Indian teacher, Acharya Asanga. Anybody who knows our refuge tree will be familiar with the figures above the head of the Buddha, who are in, is it five ranks, the teachers of the past. And at the top of those are two figures. There's Nagarjuna and Asanga. They are, in the Mahayana traditions, which is really the majority of Buddhists, would consider them to be next after the Buddha. Nagarjuna first, then Asanga. As I mentioned last night, according to some traditions, they're considered as Buddhas. So you have the first Buddha who turned the wheel of the Dhamma in the deer park at Shravasti, in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. The second Buddha is Nagarjuna through the Prajnaparamita texts and the Mula Majjhimaka Karikas, the whole Majjhimaka tradition. And then the third turning, commenting on the Samdhinamochana Sutra, Asanga and the Yogacara. So that they're very important figures, and that means that we're going to be examining a text that comes from one of the greatest teachers of the Buddhist tradition. This particular text, which we're going to be looking at a tiny part of, is really important for the whole of the Mahayana. It's seminal work for the whole of the Mahayana. So just to illustrate how important it is, I'm going to tell you a little story. Probably most of you have heard of Xuan Tsang, a Chinese master of the 7th century, who made a 17-year journey to India, where he spent many years studying at the great Buddhist universities of northern India. He went because he became confused. It's a pretty good reason. He was looking at all the teachings that were available to him, particularly all the texts, the sutras that were available to him, and he couldn't really make proper sense of it. And he considered that many of the translations were not accurate. He couldn't find a sort of integrative perspective on it all. And he felt particularly that some of the texts were in contradiction with each other. It's quite interesting, isn't it? Because in many ways, the introduction of Buddhism into China is the nearest parallel we have for the introduction of Buddhism into the West. Because in China, Buddhism encountered a highly developed culture, a very rich literary tradition, its own spiritual traditions, and it had to find ways of translating. And the whole cast of Chinese thought is so different from Indian thought. It's extremely difficult to find an accurate way of translating. So the task that Buddhists had in translating Buddhism into India is in many ways quite similar to the task that confronts us even now, because we're still in the very early days of that transmission. And they faced the same problem that we face today. Well, we don't, because we've been very fortunate to find a teacher who's done this job for us. But I remember myself in my very early days of encounter with Buddhism, just reading here and there, and was sort of tuning into one or two teachers. I just couldn't make sense of it all. So many different teachings with such different approaches. And I knew I was a Buddhist, but I didn't really know what that meant or how to carry that through. So you can imagine that Xuan Tsang has encountered the Dhamma. He's at a very early age. He became a Shramanera when he was 13. Apparently he had such a strong affinity for the Dhamma that he was drawn into it at that very early age, and he was ordained as a bhikshu at 17, so very early, and he showed himself to be an absolutely brilliant student, but he felt he's not getting, you know, what it's all about. There's too much contradiction. And so he realized that he had to go back to India to get the original texts and try to sort out what they were about. And what he particularly wanted was this text. He wanted the Yogacara Bhumi Shastra by Asanga, because it gave a syncretic view of the whole tradition. It showed how it all fitted together and where everything could be placed, so that you could say, oh, this text is in contradiction with this text because it's trying to do this job, which is an earlier job than this one, if you see what I mean. So he sought, that he went to India specifically to find the Yogacara Bhumi Shastra. He made this extraordinary journey, which we have a record of in a text called The Record of Western Kingdoms, which you can get a nice Victorian translation of. It's very, very interesting. He travelled north across the Taklamakan Desert, through into what is now Afghanistan, the Hindu Kush, into Kashmir, Gandhara, and eventually found his way to Bodh Gaya, Nalanda, and so on. And he stayed for many years at Nalanda, which you probably know is a huge Buddhist university. There's no other word for it. And there's said to have been at least 10,000 monks. I've never heard mention of nuns, but there certainly were parallel institutions for nuns nearby. You can still see this today. You can still see the quite large brick remains of this, a part of this monastery where Xuanzang would have stayed for, as I say, several years and become quite a big figure in. He became a teacher there. And he studied the Yogacara Bhumi Shastra with the leading monk, one of the chief abbots of Nalanda, for a number of years. And apparently he studied it several times. And so eventually he went with 20 or 30 horses, just packed with texts, back all the way into China. He was a bit worried about going back because he'd been told not to go by the emperor, which is a risky thing. But fortunately, 17 years later, the emperor received him joyfully. There's very famous pictures of him, and you often see statues in Chinese contexts. He's got, you know, a real rucksack on his back. It really does look like a standard North Face rucksack. Well, not exactly. Presumably made of bamboo. And it's like a sort of a library. On the back, there are compartments, and he's got rows and rows of texts. So he carried these on his back with 24 horses or whatever, all the way through this tremendously perilous journey, where he encounters so many adventures, lots of robbers and bandits and all the rest of it, but a lot of also goodwill and kindness from Buddhists once he hits Buddhist, I can say India, but it's the sort of vast Indian cultural sphere going up into Central Asia, Persia, and so on. You know, at that time, Buddhism, although it wasn't the dominant religion, it was a very, very powerful religion in the whole of the Southeast Asia. There's a lovely book by a modern Chinese woman author, whose name I can't remember at the moment, called 10,000 Miles Without a Cloud, which I strongly recommend, where she retraces Xuanzang's steps from Chang'an, where he set out, right the way through into Bodh Gaya. Beautiful book, where she sort of sees the remains of these extraordinary rich kingdoms along the route. So that's just a little story to show you how important this text was for Chinese Buddhists, but it's true of all Buddhists. There are Japanese versions, there are Korean versions, the Tibetan versions. And in all the Mahayana countries, one of the main things serious students will do is study the Yogacara Bhumi Shastra. So as I've said, this work is an attempt to provide an overview of the Buddhist tradition and to place everything in its right position. For us, it's the problem is probably not so apparent because we have a teacher who's done a lot of this work for us, who's provided us with a perspective on the Buddhist tradition which allows us to understand the whole thing. He's done it not by telling a sort of a large story about it. He's done it by showing us principles and how those principles are worked out in different traditions. Probably his nearest sort of equivalent to the Yogacara Bhumi Shastra is in A Survey of Buddhism, where he goes through the different schools of Buddhism and assigns them to one or other of the five spiritual faculties, if you remember, those of you who read it. But the Buddhist tradition is vast. It's super vast. If you see Chinese or Tibetan collections of the Buddhist scriptures, it's walls of texts. This room would just be stuffed with texts. There's so many different scriptures, that is, texts that purport to be taught by the Buddha himself, and so many commentaries by the likes of Asanga, which are considered sort of quasi-canonical. They're treated with a reverence only second to the scriptures themselves. So it's a bewildering mass. And the Buddhists of ancient times, particularly the Indian Buddhists, didn't have the historical and literary critical machinery that we take for granted. The Indians had very little historical sense. The Chinese had much more. From a quite early period, started to assign historical markers, as it were, mainly to do with the procession of emperors. But India had at very brief intervals, had any centralized authority. So there were so many kings, so many kingdoms, it wasn't easy to mark time through dynasties. So they didn't seem to have had much sense of history. And probably at that time, before Darwin and the whole idea of evolution, the whole idea that times change, if you like, and that there's a shift in cultural perspectives at different eras, which is so familiar to us now, but it just wasn't familiar to people really until the 19th century. It's only even in the 20th century that people began to realise something about cultural relativism, you know, Edward Said and all that sort of thing, where you begin to realise that cultures, when they're looking at other cultures, are looking from within their own culture at that culture. So people had very little ability to work out what this historically evolved complex of traditions and teachings and texts meant. They believed without question, the Mahayanists believed without question, that all the scriptures recorded, as well as this recording machine does, the very words of the Buddha. They believed that when they read the text, they were hearing what the Buddha said. We now know it's not true. We even know that the Pali texts, which are probably as close as we get to the lips of the Buddha, are actually several centuries after the Buddha and probably represent, you know, something pretty close to what he said, but filtered already through change of language and change of culture that alters the way in which words resonate and so forth. They didn't know that. So they had to make sense of this vast array of teachings, especially those who were Mahayanists, in other words, those who accepted this much, much vaster array of teachings and texts. They had to make sense of it. They couldn't make sense of it with a kind of literary, historical, critical, evolutionary idea that we have, where you look at the context, you understand the thing in its context, you see the relationship of the context to the one that came before it, and you can begin to tease out exactly what this text is doing. They couldn't do that. So they began to develop exegetical fictions, if you like, in which they, that the general trend of the Yogacara Bhumi Shastra is a key text in this trend. They assigned different texts and different teachings to different stages in the spiritual life. So they began to say that, well, the Buddha taught this to absolute beginners, people without much spiritual understanding and depth. And of course, you know, there is that, isn't there? One teaches differently in a beginner's class than you do in a Mitra class or whatever. So they said, well, these scriptures were preliminary, but that for those who were of exceptional spiritual intelligence and of greater development, maybe with a store of merit from countless births in the past, this text is what they need. And then, of course, there are ultimate texts that which are for the those who are just on the verge of enlightenment. So they made a sort of structure into which they fitted all the different fitted all the different teachings, all the different texts. So the Yogacara Bhumi Shastra is a vast work that outlines the whole path in all its dimensions from the very beginning right to the end. As I've said, in a sense, it's exegetical fiction, but it's and no, we can't accept it on its own terms because we're privileged by no work of our own to have inherited a way of looking at the processes of history in a more contextual way. We can understand that history is a process. We can even look at our own Buddhist history in those terms. We can see that things have evolved for certain reasons and also devolved for certain reasons. They couldn't do that. So the Yogacara Bhumi Shastra attempts to present an overview of the material available in at the time that Asanga was writing. It's pre-Vajrayana, pre-Tantric, but it's pretty much the complete picture of Mahayana. Not that's not entirely true, but pretty much most of the Mahayana sutras have by now appeared. So this is the work that we're going to be dealing with a tiny little portion of. We're going to focus on the part of the work that deals with the Bodhisattva path, because as you probably know, if you know anything about Buddhist sort of early Buddhist ideas, it was seen that there were different paths for different people. There was a Shravaka path for those who were just listeners, just hearers, who were content to follow the basic teachings, just to apply them to themselves and leave it at that. There was the Pratyeka Buddha path, which was for those who really wanted to go all the way with the path, but they wanted to do it on their own. They wanted to go off into solitude and practice very intensively and reach the goal, so to speak, by themselves. And then there was the Bodhisattva path, which was for those who saw the Buddha's life and work as much to do with personal liberation as to do with the liberation of all beings, which, of course, was considered by the Mahayanists to be the best and highest of paths. And so it's considered in the Yogacara Bhumi Shastra the pinnacle of the whole path, the system of the path, although it itself is gradated. So, graded, sorry, I don't know where I invented that word. So the Bodhisattva Bhumi Shastra, amongst other things, which is the Bodhisattva Bhumi, is part of the Yogacara Bhumi. Do you see what I mean? So you've got the Yogacara Bhumi, which contains many, many parts, principally Shravaka Bhumi, Pratyeka Buddha Bhumi, and Bodhisattva Bhumi. Bhumi meaning earth or ground or stage or step. Even today in India, Bhumi means ground, land. Bhumi Puja is what you do when you set up the foundations for a house. So these are stages or grounds for practice at different levels. So the Bodhisattva Bhumi, from which this is taken, is concerned with the six paramitas, the six transcendentalizing virtues, another new coinage, which you know is Shila. Oh no, I shouldn't set out on this without thinking about it in advance. Anyway, the six paramitas, which of course you all know, because you have to be Mitras. And amongst those paramitas is Shila paramita, the perfection of ethics. The perfection of ethics is in the Bodhisattva Bhumi, in the Yogacara Bhumi, is probably the best known part of the whole work. It's best known because it contains the Bodhisattva precepts, precepts that you need to follow if you are going to be a Bodhisattva. These are the precepts that Bhante received from Dada Rinpoche, who is now alive in our stupa, so to speak. He received them from him, and he would have received them from a tradition going back to Asanga and Shantideva and so forth, probably more or less unbroken, back to ancient India, to northern India. I'm going to say more about how we've sort of integrated those precepts, but I won't say that yet. So this is why this text is important. Asanga himself is a very interesting figure. So I'm going to tell you a little bit of a story about him. He lived in the 2nd century of the Common Era, AD. As far as we know, we don't really know so much about him. He was born in what is now modern Peshawar, in Pakistan, near where Osama bin Laden was found, just more or less next door, which was at that time a major city, huge city, that was part of the kingdom of Gandhara, which was a very, very important center of Buddhism at that time. If you go to the British Museum, there's a Buddhist gallery at the back, and you'll see some beautiful carved high reliefs, from Gandhara. And as you probably know also, that part was under the influence of Greece, of Greek culture, because Alexander the Great invaded India up to the Indus and left behind Greek kingdoms, Greco-Bactrian kingdoms in that area of Afghanistan and Pakistan and Kashmir, which survived for quite a number of years, quite a number of centuries actually, where Greek and Indian languages would have been spoken side by side, and also Central Asian languages have been spoken side by side. So, as it happens, some of Ashoka's rock-cut edicts, Ashoka the great emperor of the 3rd century before the Common Era, who converted to Buddhism and is probably responsible for us being Buddhists today, it's through his work that Buddhism became a an international religion, if you like. But Ashoka left rock-cut edicts all through his kingdom in the local languages. So in the northwest of Pakistan and I think Kashmir, there are rock-cut edicts, one or two of which are in Greek. There's quite a significant connection for us as coming from the modern West, which is so much under Greek influence. So Asanga came from that very important cultural melting pot. There are different accounts of his background and family. Some say that his father was the court Brahmin of the Raja of, can't remember the Sanskrit name for what is now Peshwa. It's very close to Peshwa. His mother was a Kshatriya, which is interesting in itself as a mixed caste. The mother was a devout Buddhist. The father was a Brahmin priest, therefore, as it were, can't say Hindu because it was pre-Hindu Hinduism, but was there to perform the Vedic rites for the court. But his mother was a devout Buddhist, and she strongly influenced her three sons because there are three members of that family, two of whom are extremely important, and they're both on our refuge tree. So the brother of Asanga, the brother we know best, is Vasubandhu, who was another very, very important figure in the founding of Yogacara Buddhism. Quite early age, Asanga became a monk in one of the earlier schools of Buddhism, the Hinayana schools, which are sort of parallel to the modern Theravada. It's the only one that's survived of the 16 major schools of Buddhism of that early period, all of which would have had more or less the same teachings, more or less the same Vinayas, more or less the same practices, but variations on small matters, which of course were very important, like exactly where you'll put your washing up when you dry it. You know what I mean? Most disputes are about very small matters, aren't they? We find in communities. They're not about major matters of doctrine. They're about small matters of etiquette and so forth. So there's small differences between these schools. It's thought that he belonged to a school called the Mahashashika school. It's not really known for sure. It doesn't matter. At a certain period, and we don't know exactly how, he came in contact with the Mahayana. So you imagine at that time in India, in North India, there's an extraordinary melting pot of Buddhism. There's all the early schools, which are based on the parallels to the Pali canon, the early scriptures, which are quite well known to us, which you can buy the Pali Text Society version of, or Bhikkhu Bodhi's wonderful translations of, well known to us in English. So all of those would have been very familiar. He'd have studied all of those. He'd know the basic teachings, Eightfold Path, Four Noble Truths, Pratichasamuppada, and all that, the very basic teachings that we learn. But at the same time, there'll be swirling around all these Mahayana texts, the Prajnaparamita texts, which we know mainly in the form of the Hridaya Sutra, Prajnaparamita Hridaya Sutra, the heart of the Prajnaparamita, which we recite in our Sevenfold Puja. So he'd have known those sort of texts. He probably would have known of Nagarjuna's commentary. Well, he certainly would have known of Nagarjuna's commentaries, which were based on those texts. The Mula Madhyamaka Karikas is the chief one, which sort of encapsulates the Madhyamaka philosophy, epistemology and logic, really. So he'd have known of that. He'd have known of many other much more arcane, even strange texts like the Sandino Mochana Sutra, which teach at an even more kind of subtle and deep level. He'd have known all of that swirling around him. And at some point, he became deeply convinced by the Mahayana perspective. Of course, he wouldn't have thought of it as Mahayana perspective. Mahayana wasn't at that point a school. You know what I mean? You couldn't look it up on Google and find where their nearest center was. It was a sort of trend, a tendency that would be swirling around amongst, particularly monks and nuns living in the big monasteries, some of whom would be focusing on the early texts, some of whom would be focusing on the more Mahayana texts, but following the same Vinaya, the same ethical codes, ethical conduct, living a shared life, but sort of interested in different dimensions of the teaching, just as we find in, amongst us, that some of us are more interested in this approach, some of us more interested in that approach, but there's a common basis to it. So there wouldn't have been a sort of organized system, as it were, but he'd have found himself more and more attracted to these much more subtle and colourful and rich texts which focused on the idea of emptiness, shunyata, that focused on the bodhisattva ideal, the idea that to really follow the Buddhist path, you had to follow it not just for yourself, but for everybody. You couldn't just follow it for yourself. To follow it for yourself was a denial of what it was. But we'll be looking at this more closely later on. And then also that the experience that there were other forces operating on a what we would call archetypal level, for better lack of a better term, which you could come into contact with. In other words, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, the archetypal Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, which could especially be experienced in meditation. A Sangha seems to have made, well, he says, he made a very strong connection with Maitreya, Bodhisattva Maitreya, who, as probably you know, is said to be the next Buddha. Once all traces of this Buddha and his work disappears, when every last Triratna Center has gone, every last Mitra has gone, every trace, even Bodh Gaya has gone, the Bodhi tree has gone, there's nothing left, then Maitreya appears and restarts the whole business all over again. This is Buddhism. The Buddhas appear when they're needed, and they re-teach, re-expose or explode the Dhamma into the world again. So Maitreya is said to be preparing himself at this very moment in the Tushita Devaloka, which is a very lofty state, realm, which parallels high meditative experience. So a Sangha apparently made contact with Maitreya, and Maitreya communicated to him various teachings. This is the way it's presented. Some scholars argue that the teacher, and there are good reasons for this, that the teacher was actually a human teacher called Maitreyanatha, which means one protected by Maitreya. But I personally prefer the idea that in deep meditation, a Sangha made contact with a Maitreya. And through his contact with Maitreya, he gained clarity on the Buddhist tradition. He gained clarity on what had come to him, and he began to communicate that. He seems to have been based in northern India, for those of you who know India, quite near Ayodhya, which is in the modern Indian state of Uttar Pradesh, which, if it was a country, would be the sixth biggest population in the world. And where we have a center quite near there. Ayodhya is important because it's also considered the birthplace of the god Rama. And there's been a lot of agitation in India recently by the Hindu nationalist movement to take back Ayodhya and make it into a center of, to reconstruct the temple to the birth of Rama. But probably it was actually a Buddhist place. I'm not just saying that because I'm a Buddhist. There actually is good evidence that it was a very important centre of Buddhism. And it's there, or near there, that Asanga taught. His brother, meanwhile, don't forget, open up a new screen, his brother Vasubandhu had been, meanwhile, pursuing another branch of the early tradition, the Hinayana, so-called, and had become a very important teacher of Abhidhamma. Abhidhamma is the trend in Buddhism that systematizes from the scriptures a philosophy and psychology, if you like, to put it that way. You can see a version of the Yogacara Abhidhamma in a book that I've seen recently on the bookshelves called Mind in Harmony. I'm not plugging anything, of course. But that's actually based on Vasubandhu and Asanga's version of the Abhidhamma. Vasubandhu himself had become a very important Abhidhammist in the old tradition. He then encountered his brother, and he was converted, so to speak, to his brother's point of view. His brother seems to have been a very, very impressive figure indeed, from what reading between the lines. He's both a very learned man. He knew a vast range of the scriptures. He's an extremely intelligent man with a very deep perception, a very great meditator, with this capacity to explore the highest realms of experience, and with very deep insight, and able to bring all that to bear to create really a new tradition within Buddhism, which his brother then signed up for and himself made not exactly equal contribution, but more or less equal contribution to. And some of his work is as widely studied as Vasubandhu. Some of you may have been at the LBC when I led a session of study on the Vijñaptimātrita Trimshika Karikas, the 30 verses on mind alone, which is by Vasubandhu, the brother of Asanga. So if your heads are not spinning too much, we've got Asanga bringing it all together, saying this is what it all means. This is how you can see it all. So you don't have to exclude anything. You don't have to reject anything. You can see it all in this vast framework. And this is a very important function of key teachers throughout Buddhist history. And myself, I place our own teacher, Urgyen Sangharakshita, in that category. At what level, only history will tell us, if you see what I mean. How important he will be for the future, we don't know. Certainly pretty important for me, and no doubt for many of you. But how much that will endure, we don't know. But he's done the same function. He's taken the vast array of Buddhism, and he's made sense of it in terms of the modern world, not just the modern Western world, because it works in India too, and no doubt it'll work in other countries as well. We have mitras, we have a mitra in China, we have mitras in Malaysia, and so on. It's going to take more time because more translation required, but that's the function that Sangharakshita has performed, to sort of distill the vast range of Buddhism, to make sense of it all without sort of plumping for one school or another, but just be a Buddhist in relation to the big Buddhist tradition and to work out a path of practice and a way of understanding things that works for us. It's not the last word, not the only word. It's never going to be finished, but it's pretty good. It does for me, and I hope for you. So you can sort of understand Asanga a little bit in the light of Sangharakshita. And again, I'm not trying to make comparisons. History has to make those comparisons. But it's a similar function that he's performed, if you see what I mean, of making sense of this huge tradition, which is in a way even more vast because it's gone on for 2,500 years and scholars are finding more and more and more. Some of the versions of the text we're going to be looking at have been found in the deserts of the Taklamakan, in old Khotanese, for instance, and other languages. So scholars are all the time finding new Mahayana texts in Nepal, in the monasteries of Nepal, and so on. So scholars are finding out so much about Buddhism. Even in my brief lifetime, the understanding of the origins of the Mahayana have changed immeasurably. A lot of what Bhante writes and even speaks of in his earlier writings about Mahayana is well out of date, which is okay because he's still making spiritual sense, even if it's not historically completely accurate. So Asanga has taken all this vast array and tried to make sense of it. One of the big jobs he had to do was to make sense of the different ethical codes that came to him. Buddhists at that time were faced, of course, with the distinction between monks and laity. We're going to look at this much more closely later on. Monks and nuns followed the Vinaya, which is a code of conduct, which is partly ethical and partly customary, which shoulder you put your robe over, and how you do things, and how you hold your bowl, and that sort of thing. And partly it is definitely ethical. Lay people follow the 5 or often the 10 precepts, the ones we follow. Then there are all sorts of other categories, again, which we'll see later on. So the question was, what is essential in all of that? What is it that really applies to everybody, especially if you want to be a bodhisattva? What is ethics for the bodhisattva? That was the question that he was trying to deal with. If you want to be a bodhisattva, whether you're a lay person or a monk or nun, how do you conduct yourself? You see? So that taking for granted this sort of distinction between the earlier path, the Shravaka path, and the Pratyeka Buddha path, and the Bodhisattva path, how, if you want to follow the Bodhisattva path, do you practice? What precepts do you follow? That was the question that he was trying to face. Of course, we've got our own debate about that, which Sangharakshita has resolved in terms of the what he calls the Mula Pratimoksha, the 10 precepts, which he discusses in the 10 Pillars, which is one of his most important works, which is a sort of equivalent of what we're going to look at Asanga doing. So Asanga's asking, what is ethics for the Bodhisattva? And the answer to that question is what we're going to be looking at. So hopefully most of the history lesson is over. I hope you haven't become dazed and confused, and I hope you're not bored. And I'm absolutely fascinated by history. I have to restrain myself from going down all sorts of historical pathways. But it is important because, again, we're looking at a text that has something to say to us, but unless we understand its context, we'll get the wrong message. Now, this is the mistake, if you like, that Buddhists have made again and again and again. They've taken something that grew up in particular circumstances, at particular times, in a particular culture, and they've tried to live in accordance with that when their own times, their own culture is so different. And part of the work that Sangharakshita has done is to show us how to appreciate what we've inherited, and that then how to recontextualize it by basing it on principles. Wow, that's a really good condensation of what Bhante's done, if I may say so. As shouldn't. Yes, he's He's shown us how to not just say, that's wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong, this is how it should be, but say, in its own context, this is what this meant, and this is what it means to us, and this is how we should play that out. So in a way, by what I've tried to explain this morning, I hope you've got some sort of picture through seeing what a Sangha did, or what Sangharakshita has done for us. And so what I'm going to try to do is to do what Sangharakshita has trained me to do, which is to look at a Sangha's Bodhisattva Bhumi Shastra, the sixth chapter, and try to show you what it meant in its own context and what it means for us and how we can use that in our own lives. And I believe that there's some very, very important teachings in here that are extremely relevant to us. So I'm hoping that in the course of this exposition, you'll get something that you can practice. So I'm sorry to regale you with quite a lot of mere sort of information and exposition. Necessarily, you know, all history is interpretation, isn't it? And a one-hour lesson in the history of early Buddhism is completely inadequate, and there will be all sorts of things that scholars, I hope there are none present, will say, come on, too. But I'm trying to give you a sort of a picture that will help you to understand what we're trying to grapple with. The text is actually quite approachable. It's not in a particularly appealing style because it's Abhidhamma. It's not stories. It's not an attempt to make it interesting. It's for those who want to have a sort of serious answer to the question, what is ethics to the Bodhisattva? So I won't be referring directly so much to the text. I'll give my own exposition of it. But for those of you who want to, you can read the background in the text. And I hope that after my exposition, you'll get a much quicker sort of glimpse of what it's really about. So you've been sitting very patiently for 50 minutes, and that's probably more than any audience should endure. Although if I was a Sangha, I'd be speaking for days, absolutely mercilessly. And you'll be rigorously writing everything down, but maybe you wouldn't have been taking much in. So let's have a break for, come back together at 12, and we'll carry on from there. This is how it's going to be, brothers and sisters, so get used to it. Oops, I'll try to, once we've got something more solid, I'll try to give some room for questions at least, but there's too many of us for discussion. It may be that it's useful at some point to have discussion, but I'm wanting to do with you something a bit more traditional, which is just give you a text, which you can then use. Okay? Have a nice cup of tea.